This is Rebecca Lowe, or Rebecca Lua, if you listen to Suboptimal Radio, and you are listening to Men in Blazers on the NBC Sports Network.
It's unbelievable!
From the Embassy Row studios in the crap part of Soho, and back again at the Embassy Row outpost in the crap part of Hollywood, Rog, it's the Men in Blazers podcast.
Oh, Dave, for old listeners, they will remember you being in LA and me being naked in your office, pressing my buttocks against your desk as an every week occurrence in the old days.
I always wondered where those sweat marks came from, Rog.
Yeah, you didn't wonder, you knew.
I'm back in Hollywood. I haven't been here for a while. It's all looking good, Rog. Very clean, very warm, and everybody's very good looking.
Yeah, but you're not the only Englishman in California right now.
James Corden premiered last night on CBS in the old Craig Ferguson slot, in the post-Letterman slot, in what will soon be the post-Stephen Colbert slot, Rog. I think he did a pretty good job.
And in the race to be the best Englishman on American television, we've just been pushed down another place in the charts.
Where were we in the charts to start with,
Rog? I'm not quite sure, but I think we just plummeted out of the top 1,000 for the first time, thanks to Corden. We're currently, actually, I'm looking at the figures overnight, we're currently the 1,012th most popular Englishman on American television.
There are people who aren't even English on that list,
Piers
right?
Piers Morgan, for comparison, is 1,011.
Oh, yeah, he's always going to take us, Rog. I think James Corden did a good job, Rog.
Yeah, if Jimmy Fallon's show and Graham Norton's show had a baby, I think it would have been that. But you're a television man. You understand these things. There's a lot of talk in the English newspapers about will he succeed in America. And by a lot of talk in English newspapers, I mean a lot of English newspapers wishing only ill upon James Corden, because English newspapers hate little more than an Englishman doing well abroad. You understand his chances. Television man, please discuss.
Well, it's a very protected time slot, Roger. It's on at 12:30 at night. That is incredibly late, even later than our suboptimal Monday night NBC Sports broadcast, Rog. It's a very protected time slot. He's a super likable guy. He's a super talented guy. He's got loads of celebrity friends already in Hollywood, and I think he's going to do just fine. The premiere was very well reviewed. You mentioned it's the love child of, I think you said, Graham Norton and Jimmy Fallon. I'd throw Andy Cohen in there. He's got a bar on his set, Rog.
I love a good threesome.
Yep.
I love a threesome, but I love the way they activated the Hanks button. Get me Hanks. I'd say about old James Corden, if he was a baseball player, he'd be the rare baseball player that can hit for average and power and steal a few bases despite his stealth kind of girth. He sings, he dances, he lads it up with charm. He really is a multi-talented threat. I think he's going to do fabulous. We spent some time this week on our show, which I actually didn't know was televised until he just said it, with another great Englishman. We had Andy Summer of The Police.
Andy Summers from The Police, Rog. One of our childhood heroes, without a doubt. One of our adult heroes.
Yeah, it was up there with having Blondie, Debbie Gibson, or John Mellencamp back when his middle name was Cougar on the show. I was completely and utterly titillated. There was a very interesting tweet we received last night from during the show. And by the way, did your Ronaldo eyebrows come off? I'm picturing you podding still with, like, looking a bit like Yogi Love.
I think they're still on, Rog. I think they're still on. I arrived in the middle of the night in LA. I haven't actually seen any humans since I've arrived here, but I think they're still on.
Oh, it's an amazing look. You looked absolutely even more gorgeous than normal. Talking about gorgeous, Brad Evans, one of my favourite US soccer players, phenomenal leader on the field, and one of the finest looking blokes I've ever seen off it. He looks like Mr. Darcy in cleats. He tweeted during our show, he said, "I challenge Men in Blazers to do a whole episode in American accents." And then the question was, would you still watch The Lads, he asked his followers. What a question.
Yeah, well, it goes back to the root question always about us is, would we be successful, Rog, if we weren't English, if we were just regular American guys with American accents? I mean, I think the answer is clearly no, we wouldn't be successful, but I'm willing to try and do the whole thing in our crappy American accent.
Well, I've got to be honest, if I was going to be candid with Brad, I'd say I wouldn't watch our show with our crap English accent.
Yeah, exactly.
But I did some research on this, and I got NBC's kind of research department to find out what the success is behind kind of the 12 and a half to 14 people who watch our show on a weekly basis. Yeah. And they wrote back and they said, apparently, the people who watch your show are mostly bald fetishists. we have an almost perfect Venn diagram overlap with the people who watch our show and subscribers to Bald and Bouncy magazine.
Yeah, well, they must not have enjoyed our cold open last night where we were Ronaldo, Rog, and Messi, where we had perfect hair.
Yeah, and a lot of you have said, why did Messi have blonde hair in that skit? And the answer to that is, we don't even have budget for post-its.
I thought you looked like Fernando Torres.
You did.
A very short Fernando Torres.
Like Nacho Monreal is a very small version of Peter Crouch.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that. David, I'm still a little bit in shock, though.
Yeah.
Because we've talked on the past couple of weeks about the rolling number of anniversaries that have kind of come as like benchmarks, the circle game, everything a season, turn. Mm-hmm. Radiohead's The Bends turning 20, which I still can't believe.
That's ridiculous.
Breakfast Club, this must be a typo, turning 30, Davo. But then I'm even more shocked this weekend when Twitter, Davo, young Twitter, turned 9 years old this weekend. Same age as Ricky Schroeder when he won a Golden Globe for The Champ.
That's amazing. And we have loved the Twitter, Rog.
Can you believe it's that old already? It's such a fixture in our lives, but it still feels so novel every time I click on it. I feel like I'm clicking on something utterly new. I can't tell whether its power's declining, as is so oft predicted, or whether I'm just completely kind of used to it. But as someone who lives and breathes football, it is the most beautiful tool for ingathering. I find it more useful for ingathering than actually broadcasting. Instagram feels like a better kind of broadcasting platform. But it is a magic tool for managing the torrent of narrative tumbling from the Premier League, European football, the US men's and women's team. I must say, the MLS Twitter, it still feels more like an insider kind of echo chamber, but I do believe in time that will change.
Rog, talking of broadcasting, I got here late at night, about 1 o'clock. I made it back to the crap part of Hollywood. Stayed up till 3:30 in the morning here, watching on my iPad, on my ESPN Cricket app, watching this amazing semi-final in the World Cup between New Zealand and South Africa in Auckland. We love New Zealand. We properly love New Zealand. We love the All Blacks. We love the All Whites, their soccer team. This is the Black Caps, Rog, and they made it through to their first ever World Cup final. Congratulations, all our listeners in New Zealand.
Yeah.
Okay, Rog, we got a packed show. We're going to break down United's narrative-laden defeat of Liverpool at Anfield, Stevie G's 38 seconds to Wilding. We're going to discuss the Von Trapp's upcoming friendlies in the first ever Winter World Cup. We're joined by a US national team midfielder with more than 200 caps. And she's a great GFOP, Heather O'Reilly, Rog.
H-A-O.
On the pod. Okay, to the football, Rog. You're going to have to crack open a Guinness for me. It's a little early in the morning over here.
There's nothing sadder than a solo Guinness open, Dave. It's to be drunk amongst friends.
Yeah, I don't mind a solo Guinness, actually.
Godspeed, David.
Godspeed. Okay, we are now 38 of the way through the Premier League season. And while the title chase has become that boring old uncle who wants to show you slides of his recent trip to Great Yarmouth, the race for the top four is the cool young aunt who sneaks you sips of Guinness, Rog. But is the top four purely ornamental for English clubs? As they can't seem to last in European competitions, Rog. All English clubs out of Europe, Rog.
Yeah, Davo, it is true. Shocking but true for those of us who look at the world through a Premier League lens. The Premier League has no representatives in the Champions League last eight for the second time in three seasons. England's manager and general genius, Davo, Roy Hodgson, he was asked about why Premier League clubs just exited from Champions League and Europa League this season, and he answered, it's just one of those things. But surely it's a little more complex than that.
Yeah, it is complex. I mean, I don't think it's about any single year, Rog. It's not like the year that Chelsea won the Champions League that England had the best league in Europe. And I don't think that the year that we don't have any teams in the last eight in the Champions League that we therefore makes us the fifth or sixth ranked league in Europe. But it's the ongoing trend of sort of year after year after year. And certainly no English club is reaching the heights of Barcelona, of Real Madrid, of Bayern Munich in this competition, Rog.
It's probably a cacophony of reasons, Dave. Yeah. I mean, the Premier League do not move the games prior to the Champions League for those teams involved to Fridays to give the teams ample time to prepare like other leagues. We don't have the winter break in which players can rest and gird their loins. There's also the concussive impact of the relentless competition in the English Premier League, where even Burnley or Hull can and will try and kick the crap out of you and occasionally beat you. We are living in a golden era for Bayern, for Messi's Barca and Ronaldo's Real, as well as PSG's resurgence. But English football, it is in transition, Davo. I mean, we've seen the tactical naivete of City chasing at Barcelona. We've seen Arsenal so arsenally in the first leg against Monaco, and Chelsea, one man superior, yet unable to kind of close out the game. Gary Neville said something fascinating, which is English clubs are so moneyed at this point. There's so much television rights money swilling around the league that European-based agents and all the super agents are European. They're not English. Are just selling them crap former stars at overinflated prices, and they're kind of paying the cost for that. But the net effect is this. MLS, congratulations. You've got as many teams left in European competition as the English Premier League right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Doing very well in Europe by comparison to those great leagues.
But I will say, Davo, after a weekend like this, who needs the Champions League when you've had... Yeah. I mean, we're almost at Passover. There's a Passover song, Dayenu. It would have been enough. And you say, you know, if you just brought us out of Egypt, Dayenu, that would have been enough. If the Red Sea had just been split and you'd only done that, that's enough. If our needs in the wilderness, if you just provide enough. And I felt like that watching the Premier League this weekend. I mean, like when the referee sent off the wrong player in the Man City game, Dayenu, that was enough for us to do a good Men in Blazers, Davey.
Yeah, that's a nice piece of narrative.
If Balotelli had been saved from a red card by a fan in the crowd, and that's all that happened, that would have
been
enough.
Would have been a great weekend.
If Harry Kane had just scored his first hat-trick.
Yeah, amazing stuff. But that would have made a show.
But then Stevie G, Davey, the 38 seconds. This was a weekend of insanity, incompetent, surplus human stupidity, and that's what keeps me watching the English Premier League. Who needs a Champions League?
And that's not even to mention Di Maria's catch inbounds, his fair catch inbounds.
There's too much to discuss, David. There's too much tuna. And we asked NBC for an hour-long slot this weekend. There was so much to put in. But they said that very nicely and very quickly, they said Babe Winkleman's hunting show is much more popular than Men in Blazers. And he's got to keep his all night.
It's amazing, Babe Winkleman's hunting show, Rod.
He is.
He's also listed on the top English broadcasters ahead of us, Rod.
Yeah.
That's the real insult.
They claim him as one of their own.
Okay, let's go to Anfield, Rog. Liverpool 1, Manchester United 2, Rog. A game that featured slapstick comedy, Greek tragedy, and even a few moments of quality football. Two goals from half-man, half-penguin Juan Mata, including a spectacular bicycle kickish volley, lifted United to victory at Anfield. But the real reason this game will live in Liverpool lore for eternity, Steven Gerrard's stamp on Ander Herrera, Rog, that had him sent off just 38 seconds after coming on as a half-time sub. Amazing stuff.
Oh, David, we should say this is the most watched game in the world. 645 million homes, 175 countries.
Yep.
Super Bowl ratings seem like a flop compared to that, but this was a very odd addition to this game. I mean, the immensity of this game is that it used to be a title decider between two regional rivals. It's now a battle between two teams perched on the edge of the top four cliff, like at the end of North by Northwest. Only one will survive by qualifying for the Champions League and getting that $104 million that comes with a top four place. I mean, you watch this game like you tuned into Nick Wallenda walk a tightrope between two Chicago skyscrapers. You kind of hope you'd see a human fall. And we kind of did see a human fall in this game. But I've got to ask you this. Before the game, if you were being honest, I was trying to rack my brains. I couldn't think of a conceivable reality in which United would win this game. Could you, before kickoff?
Well, look, certainly the primary narrative before kickoff was that Liverpool were the team on the ascendancy. Man United finding a little bit of form, but still struggling to figure a way to play. Liverpool at home with their record, certainly in 2015, it would have been tough to bet against them getting at least a point. I think that's what I predicted, Rog.
Yeah, Coutinho, Sterling, Sturridge, Hendo, so many ways to hurt teams. They fire them in off all body parts. But it was United who started with confidence. They knocked the ball around midfield. They pressed, went out of possession. Fellaini pummeled Emre Can, whom Brendan Rodgers mistakenly pre-game announced was a Rolls-Royce player. If that's true, Fellaini spent 90 minutes kicking in the fender, slashing the tyres, scraping the paint off the side of aforementioned Rolls-Royce with his keys. Liverpool could do nothing to stop him. And a goal came quickly, courtesy of a Herrera pass. It was erotic, Davo, wasn't it?
Oh, it was an amazing pass from Herrera right out of midfield. All of those midfielders at Man United just had fantastic games. Ball releases Juan Mata on the right side of the penalty box and a fantastic finish into the left-hand side of the goal, Rod.
Oh, it was cuter than an Ewok, the goal. And his joy, Davo, no matter how you feel about Manchester United, Juan Mata's joy for life, it's infectious. Yep. And after seeing him come out back from the periphery, Honestly, it was like seeing a club seal come back to life. It was that beautiful to watch. And then we had him kick the corner flag with a little bit of tiny Spanish aggression, which was quickly marked.
We've never seen that before.
It was we haven't, but it was quickly matched by Dutch macho aggression.
Oh, Dutch macho. Louis van Gaal getting a little aggressive in his managerial area with his assistant, Rog.
And Ryan Giggs, who got slapped on the face. At time for Miller tweeted, just like any real professional, slapping another professional in a work environment, that's football. What I loved about Van Gaal's slap, because I've now watched it close to 200 times with producer JW, it was such a conscious decision, David. It wasn't in the moment of celebration. If you watch it, the goal goes in, the camera's cut to Van Gaal, who kind of looks around, gets up, and then he takes his time. And then it's as if he suddenly dawns on him that he'd made a pre-game note that he had to continue to emasculate Ryan Giggs. United legend, 13 league titles, 2 Champions League. And he just turned around and started to cuff him on the face. And there's a second, if you watch it in exquisite slow-mo, where Ryan Giggs looks at him. You said it yesterday.
Oh, that's what I love about it, Roger, is Ryan Giggs' reaction is for the first second and a half, I honestly thought that Ryan Giggs was going to hit him. I really, and by the way, that would have been the, I would have exploded had that happened. But it really looked like he was going to hit him before he broke into
this. The second time he's done, do you think Giggs likes a slap because it means United have just scored and he welcomes that? He's a team player. Or do you think it makes him seethe? It makes him seethe, right?
No, it absolutely makes him seethe. I mean, we've talked about the Jose Mourinho power grab. It is the ultimate power move to slap another man on the face just a little bit too hard.
I was trying to think, do you think it stings more when it happens? Or afterwards, when it's a meme and everywhere on the internet and everyone keeps asking him about it.
I think we need to stay tuned to this because knowing the Premier League, this is only going to escalate. I did notice
when United scored the second, fool me twice, Ryan Giggs kept his distance. He put about 4 feet between him and Van Gaal. But the game went on. Liverpool just unable to work the ball wide. United pushed up the flanks through their wing backs. They dominated the game. Sturridge, so deadly, so often, was just a spectator. Yeah. And I started to feel a nostalgia amongst United fans who were being taken back to the days when their teams were routinely this good. But then Liverpool changed to a diamond. Lallana on the left started to create more danger. And then the chance came and he blasted it wide. Dave, he was shaken up still after that bone-crunching Phil Jones hit.
Yeah, he'd just been crunched by Phil Jones. And that was what was... Look, there was a lot of people talking about the incisive final third play of Manchester United, almost vintage Alex Ferguson Man United. But what I was more impressed with in this game, what I found more remarkable, was the steel that Man United showed at the back. Their much maligned defence, Rog. Remember from earlier in the season, Phil Jones, Chris Smalling looked... I can't believe I'm saying this. Chris Smalling looked world-class, Rog, in this game. You've already talked about Fellaini with his... just metal in the centre of midfield, Rog. Just that was what was impressive to me. And that, I think, was getting to Liverpool. They don't like it up them, Rog.
By the end of the first half, when that whistle went, I noted in my book, it was like watching two tiny terriers frantically hump your leg for 45 minutes. It was frantic stuff.
Yeah.
Little did we know, though, Davo, that the second half was about to be Premier League football as if hand-painted by Salvador Dali himself. So much happened in the second 45, I wouldn't have been more surprised, Davo, post-game, if someone had melted on the field or just spontaneously combusted.
Yeah, it got surreal, Rod. I mean, obviously, coming into this game, we've all heard the rumours that there's discord, there's a rift between Brendan Rodgers and Steven Gerrard. Steven Gerrard, whatever Brendan Rodgers says in press conferences, there's no way he likes sitting, there's no way he likes being on the bench in his final run, in his final games that he's going to play in the club that he's loved since he was a boy, Rog. He comes on in the second half, and it all starts so well for him, Rog.
Yeah, he managed. I mean, this is amazing, David. 38 seconds in which Steven Gerrard managed to stuff 2 short passes, 1 Hollywood long ball, a brutal tackle on Juan Mata. I thought Stevie G had just killed an Ewok.
Yeah.
And then the Ndamukong Suh of a stamp on Herrera. 38 seconds, David. The whole performance was so confusing.
Yeah.
No, when the red card was lofted,
yeah,
nobody seemed to know what the hell was going on. There was so much confusion, mostly because English legends don't get immediate red cards in modern football.
Yeah, and English legends, and well, some English legends do, but Steven Gerrard, you just don't see that happening to him after 38 seconds in a Premier League game. Having said that, the stamp was awful. I think Gerrard's own admission is the stamp was awful. And there's no doubt that that was a straight red card, Rog.
Yeah, I mean, at Ray Boss tweeted us, when Rodgers told Gerrard he had 45 to make an impact, Stevie G obviously thought he meant 45 seconds.
Yeah, we did that.
And it's interesting you say about the tackle. If you're a Chelsea fan and you see the kind of negative press that one maybe Diego Costa has gotten for the stamp, or if you, I mean, you watch how Martin Skrtel has been vilified for the end of the game, you could say that to some degree the English papers have given Stevie G a little bit of a pass. But we've got to ask before we get into that, why did he do it, Dave? What was going on in his head? The English papers have talked about his will to win.
Yeah, I wonder how much, I mean, obviously the obvious narrative, the easy answer is, oh, he was upset about being left out, and he came on and he needed so much to prove himself that it all went to his head and he got overexcited. I actually think that it was the specific sequence of events that happened in the first 38 seconds that might have led to this. It's almost like a building momentum of red mist. You know, you get so charged up with your adrenaline, you make those two short passes, you do the dribble take on, you then hit that Hollywood long ball out to the right wing. You're feeling pretty good. You then do a bone-crunching, vintage Stevie G tackle on Juan Mata. Probably the last person in the world we want to see bone-crunched like that. He's got to be feeling great, and Herrera comes in on him. One should say a little bit late. But at that point, the stamp, I think it was the sequence of events that built the pressure there, Roger.
The English papers, they have. They've talked about the will to win that gave Liverpool the greatest night of their life in recent times in Istanbul in the Champions League. But for me, this was more about human turmoil, David. The will to win, one ingredient, but there's an element of the lion in winter. The confusion surrounding a team leader unsure of his own position. Deterioration between Gerrard and Brendan Rodgers, which is oft talked about. And the anxiety of a one-club man about to be exiled across the ocean like Barristan cellmate. I mean, I interviewed Stevie G in Liverpool last year, and I asked him about a paragraph from his autobiography, which I love. He said in his autobiography, I was put on this earth to steam into tackles. For most professionals, tackling is a technique. For me, and it's an adrenaline rush. The sight of the other team with the ball makes me sick. It makes him sick, Davo. He says, I have to claim it back. It's my ball. I'm going for it. Tackling is a collision which sorts out the cowards from the very brave. And I asked him last year, does he still feel like that now he's a veteran pro at the end of his career? And he paused and he chuckled for a second. And then he answered with two words. He said, even more. And that's what I think happened here. This was his last game against United. His team needed a jump start. They've been terrible in that first half. All those memories, all that emotion, all that responsibility, coupled with the insecurity of his own predicament, adrenaline-fueled descent into madness.
Yeah, well, he is an adrenaline player, Rog. I mean, I would say athletes are no different than mere mortals like us, Rog, is that, you know, within their greatest strengths are also revealed their greatest weaknesses. He's an adrenaline player. That's what helped him lead that incredible comeback in the Champions League final from 3-0 down. But that's also perhaps what caused this moment of rashness. I think we'll remember the Stevie G far more of the comeback in Istanbul than we will the Stevie G getting sent off.
You think, David? I mean, it is interesting. I was blown away by his immediate press conference. He could have hid.
Oh, well done.
He didn't. It was a courageous move for a professional footballer who, I mean, they don't try and take those risks often. But having said that, the end of Gerrard's Liverpool career, it's been tainted by folly, the slip last season, the stamp now, the 38-second red card. It's almost like he's suffering like a martyr on his way into sainthood. The George R. R. Martin quality of the ending of his career, and this is what I worry about for Stevie G, it does the whole a disservice because many Americans are new fans to this game. They don't remember Istanbul. They don't know the whole. They don't know the story of Stevie G, a local lad, a homegrown talent, a phenomenal midfielder in his prime, a club talisman, dragged that club to European heights. Anyone who watched him as a young player and remembers that drive, how he propelled the club with his all-round play, his leadership, they know how much of a career it was to savour. I'd never wish this upon any kind of great, David. It really is. It's like seeing a lion in winter baited.
I think his legacy is secure amongst Liverpool fans. I think you're drawing the conclusion that might be felt by the larger swathe of the British media and the footballing world outside of Britain and in America. And I think you're right, many people haven't seen the greatest of Steven Gerrard, but I think that he is a appearing breed in the Premier League. Players like Stevie G, players like John Terry, obviously a very different kettle of fish, but these one-club pros, these one-club English pros, we're not going to see anymore. And this is why supporters of those individual clubs, they seep into the club culture and into the club's lore like no other foreign players.
I thought you were going to say Frankie Lampard there, but you might not know, he played for Chelsea before he played for Manchester City. A lot of people don't know
he
that.
He played for West Ham before he played for Chelsea as well.
Brett just one tweeted us and said, when you're sent off, you go for an early shower. When it happens 45 seconds into your shift, do you just wash your face?
That's what my mother calls a French horse bath, that you wash yourself standing up at a sink. Maybe he did take a French horse bath.
If you want a serious answer to the question, I think he just slapped some Dracar around his undercarriage, fired two pumps of mist into the air and then walked through them front ways and backwards and was ready to go. I mean, the game was then just a descent into madness, Di Maria catching the ball in bounds, which may be his great highlight as a United player when he moves.
Season highlight.
When he moves abroad. Next year, the sight of Balotelli being restrained by Liverpool fans from attacking Chris Smalling and possibly getting a second red card, the Rooney miss penalty kick, Davo, and the Martin Skrtel stamp. I mean, Man United, by the way, Man United fans have freeze-framed the Skrtel stamp, so it actually looks like the Slovakian is grinning with pleasure as he stamps on poor De Gea. But amidst all that slapstick, thank God one man could still play great football, Juan Mata.
Yeah, Juan Mata, that second goal, Rog, just a beautiful, beautiful Premier League goal. Would make any highlight reel of Premier League goals, Rog, within its entire history. Ball comes in from the left. That, I think, actually more difficult than a bicycle kick, Rog. The sort of diagonally upright bicycle kick, and knocks it past Mignolet.
It was like a Dude Perfect YouTube video. It's the only only other place I've ever seen that happen, or Stevie Naismith doing it routinely in training. And I'll say on the record, I'm so happy for Mata. He writes a beautiful blog. We've talked about it on this pod before. He signs off every posting, hugs. And he wrote later on his blog of what this game, Manchester United Liverpool, meant to him when he was a child in Spain playing football on muddy pitches in the rain. He's a soldier poet, that little Ewok. And to me, this was his Battle of Endor. I love Van Gaal's words after the game. What did he call him?
He called him a false right winger. I don't even know. I honestly don't know what a false right winger is. Certainly, his goals. If what he means is that Mata got central to score both of his goals, that is true. It was like an old-fashioned inside right, Rog, where he scored his goals from.
I think he means he's half Ewok, half man. Yeah. I also loved how they, after the game, they asked Van Gaal to immediately comment on Juan Mata. What do you think of Juan Mata? Essentially, he's twisting the knife because Juan Mata has been kind of locked into a little cupboard under the stairs at Old Trafford for several weeks when United were floundering. And Van Gaal was hardly effusive. He looked sternly at the interviewer and said, and this is a direct quote, Juan Mata, he's my most constantly playing player. Most constantly.
In what for world we live.
Oh, twisted, twisted, twisted. But whatever the outcome, 2-1 and an incredible narrative flip, because United to me this season, they've seemed like the footballing equivalent of Adult Swim's Too Many Cooks. But suddenly this week, Louis van Gaal, a genius. United, a buried giant, starting to wake from its slumber. Champions League qualification is theirs to lose. LVG has got some very interesting choices about what to do or what not to do with Di Maria and RVP now. The team looks better without them and Falcao. But Liverpool's narrative, forget that they'd won 26 points out of the last 30. The narrative already, and I don't believe this narrative, Gerrard shame, Sterling and Henderson rumoured to want out, Skrtel stamp, Emre Can has taken a step back. I'll say the truth is, what Liverpool have accomplished this season is miraculous, phenomenal, this second half of the season. There's a huge amount of football still to be played, and I think you write them off at their peril.
Yeah, no, you're very right. Just 5 points behind, there are a lot of games still to come. I think one interesting fact, Rog, is to look at the Daily Mail published the top five table. I know it's meaningless, but it still reveals something about these teams. In a top five table, so you take the fixtures this year just featuring United, Chelsea, City, Arsenal, Liverpool.
So the big game, the big games, teams playing each other, you mean?
Yes, playing each other. United are top of that table. And I think their performances against the big clubs, I think that speaks to some extent to the kind of manager Van Gaal is. But he's also a Premier League newcomer. He hasn't learned that 38-game season and how to get those tough wins away from home at the Burnleys, at the Hulls, at the West Bromwich Albions, at the places where it's very, very tough to go.
He's no Dick Advocaat. You look at these run-ins, Liverpool, two massive games to play still against Arsenal and against Chelsea. The rest seem eminently winnable. Newcastle, Hull, West Brom, QPR, Palace, Stoke, United. And you talk about them being big game moisters. City, Chelsea, Everton and Arsenal still await in their running. There is plenty to go still in this big four race, David.
Yeah, and we should write off Tottenham and Southampton at our peril, Rod.
We do.
Also, I mean, a lot can happen.
Can we just spare a minute, Davo, to talk about one man, Pele, the bloke from the Subway commercials?
Yeah. I think he used to play football as well. I think for the New York Cosmos.
Yeah, I say, to see that man shilling with his double Subway lapel pins in his collars, yeah, it made me unbearably sad. This is a gentleman who touched greatness and has frittered away a fortune with one terrible business decision after another to essentially become Jared from Subway. I was trying to think of a legacy that's been more poorly handled. He's fresh off his craven backing of Sepp Blatter for FIFA president. It's becoming clearer and clearer to me, and I know this is not a popular position in America. Pelé's great contribution to world soccer is that he became the sport's first global advertising hoarding. Either that, or Man United are going to sign him to play alongside Falcao.
Yeah, it might not be a bad idea. I was amazed, though, Rog, at the number of British members of the esteemed British footballing media who posed for photographs with Pelé on social media this week.
Subway is so much more popular in England than you think
yeah,
it is.
That's very true. That's actually a very good point. I hadn't taken into account his endorsement of the British media's favourite sandwich.
Yeah, the $5 footlong there is the five threepence footlong.
Exactly.
It's incredibly popular. They're very badly fed.
Yeah, very true. Okay, Rod, onwards to Hull. Hull City 2, Chelsea 3. An ugly but ultimately utilitarian win for Mourinho's men at the KC Stadium. After going up 2-0 behind Eden Hazard and Diego Costa's goals, a series of ridiculous mistakes allowed Hull to level the score. But in the 77th minute, substitute Loic Remy steered the ball through Hull keeper Alan McGregor's legs. It's the only way to score against Alan McGregor, to give Chelsea a six-point cushion at the top of the table with a game in hand.
It was the oddest of games. I do want to know what emotions you went through, because they went up so quickly.
Yep.
And Stevie G could only have fitted in three substitute appearances in the time that it took Eden Hazard to score from long range. Kind of goal that makes you ask, why aren't there more goals scored like that?
Yeah, why doesn't Eden Hazard score more goals like that, Rog?
And then Diego Costa doubled the lead with a rare goal from a Chelsea striker. And when that goal went in, the only question seemed to be, 2-0 up, Chelsea Football Club against lowly Hull, how many goals would Chelsea score? How fast would they fly in? And what would the players do with their Premier League win bonuses?
Yeah, well, I mean, in recent weeks, Rog, I've not been feeling my customary confidence in this Chelsea team. They've leaked away so many 1-0 leads. We've talked before on the pod about 2-0 being the most dangerous lead in football. And, you know, they looked a little rickety. You know, Chelsea's problems, they fielded only 22 players all season. And frankly, six of those players have barely played more than 10 minutes. It's just the same players again and again and again, and you've got tired players across that team. I am convinced that Ivanovic is still carrying an injury to his feet, Rog, and both of his feet. He can barely run, he can barely kick, and he can barely walk at this point. And certainly, when Hull broke down the left, he and Willian conspired in some comical defending to allow the ball to come across to Al Mohammadi to go and get one back. And
yeah,
then panic ensued, Rog.
Oh, yeah, it was a real striker's tackle by Ivanovic on that one, by the way. Panic ensued, Courtois with a Cesc Fabregas-esque assist for the Hull City equaliser. But you look at that, overall, Davo, 2-2. Hull City had 19 shots in total. Chelsea had just 8.
Yeah, I think that's the most shots that Chelsea have conceded all season as well, Rog.
Was there a moment when you were panicking about the result of this game, or like when the eventual goal went in from Loic Remy, crap goal, but they all count, from a man who's been kind of thrown into the old substitutes bin, an unlikely saviour perhaps. When that goal went in, I loved watching Mourinho on the sideline. He was like looking fearful 1 second, and then he pumped his fist alpha male style as if result, never in doubt. Was there a moment when you panicked?
Oh, I thought it was going to end in a draw, Rog. Frankly, had Courtois not made that triple save, Rog, late in the second half, I think they might have lost the game. And I think that Chelsea do have this sense, there seems to be a sense across the team that they're limping towards the title. Look, winning a Premier League title even in a year where I don't think the play has been vintage by any standard, winning a Premier League title with so many competitive teams at the top, with so many competitive teams throughout the league, Rog, is never, ever, ever going to be easy. It's not going to be easy for Chelsea in the final nine games either. I was at a certain point in that second half thinking, you know what, I'll take a point. At least it moves us one step closer.
They are like a cyclist in the Tour de France who's been caught by the peloton and trying to drag their exhausted bones over the finishing line. Apart from, bizarrely, the peloton is not getting any closer to catching them, because English Football League, as David Moyes said this week, is the worst he's seen in a long time. Talking about managers, can I just say, I love Steve Bruce.
Who does not like Steve Bruce, Rog? He's so great for the game.
Watching him wobble around the sideline, cuddling the official, giving him a back and pet rub from behind, made me so happy. In Julius Caesar, Shakespeare has Caesar say to Antony, "Let me have men around me that are fat." I just love him for that reason. I'd love to get him, of all the English managers, I'd love to get him in the panic room for after the pies. And I bet if we baked a big enough pie, we could get him in there too.
I think there's a lot for Chelsea's rivals, though, to sort of take from this game and to look at how to play them. Their susceptibility to the long ball over the top, Rog. I think you've got to look at Willian and Ramirez. I would love someone to tell me, how are Willian and Ramirez briefed pre-game, and how are they doing against that briefing? I have no idea what either of them, what their role is on this team and what they're trying to achieve. Enough of my ranting on Chelsea's smalls, Rog. Okay, Manchester City 3, West Brom 0. The citizens bludgeon West Brom after a case of mistaken identity. Left the Baggies with 10 men less than 2 minutes in. Referee Neil Swarbrick mistakenly sent off Gareth McCauley for Craig Dawson's challenge on Wilfred Bony. City would go on to shoot 43 times, scoring thrice.
Manchester City entered the game after a bruising run, losing 4 out of 5. They've just been humiliated by Barcelona. The pressure on Pellegrini seems to be taking its toll. I noticed before the game, Davo, he's the baldest man with the most hair I've ever seen in my life, which I put down to the stress of this season's run as Premier League manager. But this was a far from stressful game. It was effectively over in 1 minute 29 seconds, quicker than the Ronda Rousey fight, after a frenzy of racial profiling. What have we got to say about this? The fastest dismissal in the Premier League this season, and probably among the top three wrongest.
Yeah, well, once again, you know, we've seen this happen last season. It's happened already once this season, Rog. It's and of course, all the calls in the British media across the world for review, for video review to stop this from happening. Just remarkably silent in this entire dispute are the English referees. Surely they don't want to be humiliated like this. Come on, bring in video review. It's so easy to straighten this kind of stuff out.
Yeah, I mean, in fairness, though, on this one, Gareth McCauley could play Craig Dawson if Hallmark ever wanted to shoot a biopic of his life in their series of Know Your Anonymous Premier League Talents.
Yeah, and they were wearing the same shirt, Rog.
At YN Wajeb tweeted us and said, "A baffling decision by Neil Swarbrick, but I swear I heard Tony Pulis say to his men, quote, 'Playing with 10 men is a wee bit more fun.' It might have been fun for Pulis, but as a viewing spectacle, it became about as interesting as watching a medieval siege televised live. City took a leaf out of every sieging forces playbook. They employed a variety of catapult siege engines. They fired stones, fireballs, dead disease sheep, cattle, beehives, animal excrement, plague victims over the castle walls. And West Brom countered by dropping sulfur, hot sand, molten lead, boiling tar from their murder holes onto assorted Manchester City attackers below. It was lovely, though, to see Wilfred Bony break the deadlock on 27 minutes. First goal for City.
He could be very, very valuable to them down the stretch, not only in their race for the title, Rog, but in this battle for second, third and fourth with Arsenal and Manchester United.
Great finish by Bony. Strangely, no trademark crap celebration dance, which makes me think that Swansea must own the patent on that. There's so much I admire about Bony. Mostly I've realised I love his snug shorts. Few players wear them more John Stockton-y. He clearly wants us to understand the etymology of his last name. But from that point on, City were so dominant, West Brom didn't even have a chance to make Vincent Kompany look incompetent.
Actually, you talk about his last name, his first name, Wilfred. I love the name Wilfred. One of my great regrets is I've not had a son named Wilfred.
Talking of Kompany, by the way, huge decisions. You talk about Ramirez and Willian being dead wood for Chelsea. Of the 11 who lost to Barcelona for City, only Sergio Aguero is under 27. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when you think about the core of that team, Aguero, Joe Hart, Kompany, Fernandinho, David Silva, will probably still be around in years to come. Yaya Toure, Bakary Sagna, Di Michaelis, Kolarov, Nasri, James Milner dithering about his contract, Clichy, Zabaleta, Navas, Fernando, Jovetic, Dzeko. We're looking at a club poised for massive transition, which is hard to believe after all the money they've kind of spunked.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think part of that explains this sort of weird thing going on at the top of the Premier League is that I have to admit, even as a Chelsea fan and an NYCFC fan, Rog, that the two teams leading the Premier League are in some ways the two least inspiring teams in the Premier League. And some of it is to do with their age. Some of it is to do with the style of football they play. Some of it, I'm sure, is to do with the money. I have a feeling that both clubs are going to be pulled apart in the off-season. Okay, Rog, a team that are playing exciting football, Arsenal, travel to Newcastle, beat the Toon 2-1, and Olivier Giroud brace earns the Gunners all 3 points in a tale of two halves. Arsenal dominated the first 45 before a second-half Newcastle barrage. Arsene Wenger's men remain third, 1 point off City for second.
Oh, what Arsenal? They entered the game, 5 straight league victories, slumping Newcastle. You expected them to be cannon fodder. They were crippled by injury and suspensions. They could barely field a full substitute bench. But Newcastle employed a shock tactic, which was not coming out and playing dead. Instead, they set up to counter sprightly. But yeah, it didn't seem to matter in the first half. Olivier Giroud, he always scores against the crap teams. And before you get too angry, Arsenal fans, let's be honest, every team is pretty crap in the Premier League this season. He scored first with his meaty French knee-pam, which is his 5th straight Premier League game with a goal, and then that second with a forehead, which begat a philosophical question. If Olivier Giroud scores with his meaty French forehead and Arlo White isn't there to commentate on it, does it make a sound?
Yeah, I'm increasingly of the belief, Rog, that if Arlo White isn't commentating on it, it's not actually happening. Anything.
In life?
Yeah.
In life?
It's Arloism.
I mean, the second
Newcastle, in truth, though, came back hard at Arsenal in this game. And it played better from 2-0 down than they did at any other point in the match.
Yeah, I mean, the second half was world of weird in this weekend of weird. One of the most Arsenal-y 45 minutes of the season. I don't know what Newcastle's temporary manager, John Carver, said to the team in the locker room. Mm-hmm. But if a compact disc called Great John Carver Halftime Team Talks was released, I would definitely buy it after this one. Within 3 minutes, Sissoko pulled a goal back. And then Arsenal wilted. Daoud Yanmat propelled Newcastle. The Arsenal midfield evaporated. Arsenal managed 2 shots in the second half. Newcastle had 11. But they couldn't summon an equaliser, mostly because of Coquelin, who's like a one-man defensive line. The game was like watching him remake Rambo First Blood on home video in his own front garden. 6 straight wins now for Arsenal. Liverpool away. And if this form holds, Dave, form being results, not exactly how they played against Newcastle, second could be a real goal, as exclusively predicted by you at the start of the season.
Yeah, well, I actually think that Arsenal were the best team in the Premier League this season. I think they play the best football. I think they've got the best players. I think they've got the best team front to back. And they've also got a great manager, but for some reason they just don't find a way to go over the top. I still think Arsenal are the greatest threat to Chelsea to win it, partly because they play Chelsea on the way in, Rog, which City don't. That's going to be a 6-pointer. That game's coming up in a few weeks. It's going to be a thriller. Okay, across North London we go. Tottenham, 4. Leicester, 3. Rog, England's, and soon to be Real Madrid's, Harry Kane puts 3 past a resolute Leicester, giving him a staggering 29 goals in all competitions this season, Rog. The former Leighton Orient loanee, the Foxes, meanwhile, sit in last place, 3 points off QPR.
English Jesus scores again and again and again. The miracles keep on coming. 11 goals in his last 8 Premier League appearances. He trails only Lionel Messi for goal production in 2015. An Englishman is the English Premier League's top scorer. Spurs scored with all 4 shots on target. I mean, here he scuffed in slops. He banked the ball in off his opponent's face. And most shockingly, and perhaps most un-English of all, he converted a penalty. If the late, great Freddie Mercury was still alive, wouldn't he watch Harry Kane and pick up his pen and write, is this a real life or is it just fantasy?
Shakespeare would write about Harry Kane, Rog. Everybody. Medieval druids would write about Harry Kane,
Rog. There'd be ballads. Yeah. I mean, the hat-trick was probably doubly fulfilling for Kane. He played for Leicester on loan in the 2012-13 season for the last 3 months. Nigel Pearson, Leicester's manager, largely kept him on the bench. He scored 2 goals in 15 appearances. Pearson here looked on like Thomas in the Bible. He first doubted Jesus before leaving as an apostle. But the game also featured defending that could only be described as very, very Spursy.
Yeah, they conceded 3 to Leicester. It was a hell of a football game, Rog.
Yep, 20-minute, 2-goal claps that gave Leicester hope. Only 4 teams have conceded more than Tottenham in the Premier League this season. The other 3 are in the relegation places, but Kane righted the Spurs ship, finishing off the best hat-trick since the Father, Son and the Holy Ghost. We asked, what would an English Jesus do if one existed? I just love those words together, an English Jesus. It's the most, it makes my brain just completely have synapses. What miracles, Davo, other than turning Big Macs into pies and water into Guinness, would an English Jesus do?
You'd make it stop raining. That would be the first act of an English Jesus, Rog.
You'd make us feel good about the Commonwealth, David.
Yeah, it'd give us natural sunglasses.
Oh, that's not English Jesus. That's Sunglasses Hut. Expand already, would you? Is This Blood said, if there was an English Jesus, his first order of business would be teeth straightening. # Harry Kane, false gods.
Amazing to see where Harry Kane goes the next few weeks. A lot of speculation. He's going to suit up for England's under-21s this summer, Rog, in the European Under-21 Championships. That would be an amazing thing to see. Southampton 2, Burnley 0, Rog, as the race for European spots heats up. The Saints refuse to go quietly into the night. Shane Long hit home from close range before Clarence captain Jason Shackle turned one into his own goal. Southampton climb to within a point of Liverpool for 5th, Rog.
Forgotten Southampton by many, but they find a way to grind on. Keep getting these winning results and their hopes continue unabated. I've spoken to a couple of people at the club this week and they still have their sights set on some on the top 4, others on the top 5 place, even though they've got problems at both ends of the field. Graziano Pelle, Davo, which the Italian Harry Kane, 10 goals in his first 13 games. He's not scored in the league since 20th December. Southampton's opening goal revolved around him whiffing on a remarkable chance. He also hit the bar from 6 yards out. And how they proceed now without wonder goalkeeper Fraser Forster, who's got a touch of the Wilding about him, but is lost to a knee injury for an unspecified amount of time. How they cope without him, that may define the outcome of their season.
Yeah, that's a big loss because he and the entire defensive unit have had a very, very good season up to this point, Rog. Okay, in other games, West Ham 1, Sunderland 0. Sunderland lose their first match under the stewardship of Dutchman Dick Advocaat Diafra. Sacco scored an 88th-minute winner to secure the points for the Hammers, Rog.
The Dick Advocaat bump. Sunderland only lost 1-0. That's the bump for the little general. Decline the general. He's got a surprisingly strong scarf game. He's now declared Sunderland must now win ugly. That's his quote, which is pretty much what his predecessors have been trying to do for the last 2 decades. First West Ham United win since January. And we should say, talking about the Dutch invasion of the Premier League on the management level, congratulations to GFOP Billy Bean, who signed as a consultant with AZ Alkmaar, who've tasked him with closing the gap or helping them close the gap on big spending clubs in the Eredivisie. That's a club Aaron Johansson is at. And if you're listening, Billy, just get Aaron Johansson the ball. That's all you bloody well need to do. He's a slice of magic. I was actually in Alkmaar last summer.
Yeah,
its stadium, the luxury box, the luxury bar at the stadium is called the Louis van Gaal Bar. Maybe Billy's only signed on just so he can improve his Dutch.
Also, he can get slapped in the face, Rog. Aston Villa 0, Swansea City 1, an 87th-minute Bafétimbi Gomis goal sees the Swans pass Villa, who remain just 3 points off the relegation zone. And Stoke 1, Crystal Palace 2. Palace storm back from 1-0 down to sink Stoke. Palace have now won 8 of the 13 matches in all competitions since Super Alan Pardew took over. What a comeback for the big man.
At Adam Crofton tweeted us and said, Crystal Palace have just gone ahead of Newcastle United. They were 10 points behind Newcastle when Pardew took over at the turn of the year. And I'd only add to that, somehow sackpardew.com is still operating as a live website.
That's hilarious and so English. QPR 1, Everton 2, goals from Seamus Coleman and Aaron Lennon lift the Toffees to victory at Loftus Road and send them 9 points clear of the relegation zone, Rog. We got a tweet from GFOP at Kenny Tom. He asks, what's Everton's record since you stopped watching 3-0, hashtag conscientious objector. Did you watch this game, Rog?
I didn't watch it, but I've got to be honest. Everton's record is 3-1 since I stopped watching. And the reason there's a womp is because I actually did watch their Europa League debacle against Kiev. I couldn't help myself.
Why? Why?
I can't describe what it was that drew me to it. I laughed at my kind of like ridiculous, superstitious kind of approach to the whole thing, which you've mocked repeatedly. So I thought, I can do no harm. It's not about me. I tuned in and then I watched on in horror, Dave, as my beloved Blue Boys were mowed down. There can be no other word for it. They were mowed down 5-1 in Kiev. It was less like watching a football game. It was more like just watching on helplessly as someone operates heavy machinery while they're drunk, with a number of small children and sweet little animals that you love play dangerously close to that aforementioned heavy machinery.
So you watched the Chelsea game that was going on at the same time. Do you realise that you may have not only have... you certainly may have caused... Everton to win, but you may have also caused Chelsea to win also.
I wouldn't overinflate my powers, Dave.
Yeah.
But watching Kiev play Everton, I realise teams have clued on to Everton's one weakness this season, which is that they are total crap. And I'll say that the pain of losing, Dave, watching them lose over and over this season, I realise in the Kiev game is worsened by the fact that when I do watch, my Twitter notifications pile up with Americans that I've persuaded to become Everton fans over the past 5 years.
Well, we meet them everywhere we go.
They always ask me, what have I done to them? Why did I make them an Everton? All I'll say to you is, stay the course. It's character building. This was a massive win for Everton. We were crap, but we were playing Queen's Park Raisins. Thank you, Raisins. Thank you. And now I just have to worry about next season and our squad of burnt-out olds, our young players completely bereft of confidence, and our big stars who reportedly want out of the club. But for now, Davo, for this week, I'm going to savour the safety and delight of mid-table obscurity after a train wreck of a season. That mid-table place, that irrelevant mid-table, kind of second cousin of the bar mitzvah, Davo, it's never felt so good.
Oh, you love it. You love it, Rog. Okay, in MLS and US men's national team news, Rog, busy weekend in MLS. FC Dallas remained perfect after a 2-0 win at Philadelphia. And the New York Red Bulls, Rog, down East Coast rival DC United behind goals from BWP, Bradley Wright Phillips, and Lloyd Pham. Many of MLS's biggest stars will head to Europe this week for international duty with the USA and the under-23 team, Rog, who are playing in Bosnia. The Von Tratts take on Denmark Wednesday and Switzerland next Tuesday. Are you excited, Rog?
I am, Davo. I mean, this is a young squad rife of new faces, couple of dual nationals, Mexican-American defender Ventura Alvarado, 22-year-old who plays with Club America in Liga MX, and another Mexican-American, Club Leon's William Yarbrough, an eccentric goalkeeper, the son of Texan missionaries to Mexico. Going to be very interesting to see what happens with their futures and where they pledge to play their international football. It's also going to be interesting to watch how Julian Green and DeAndre Yedlin play, both young starlets battling the challenge of trying to establish themselves in the starting squads of their respective club teams. Also a chance to see how Aaron Johansson slots back in after injury. I'm sure Billy Beane will have completely changed his game already.
So US men's national team against Denmark, that's on Wednesday, Rog, 3:30 Eastern time on ESPN2. And then next Tuesday, on the 31st of March, they play against Switzerland. That's a good team, Rog, noon on Fox Sports 1. Congratulations to GFOP, NYCFC forward Keary Shelton. Made the under-23 team, Rog. Looking forward to seeing how he does. Okay, World Cup, Rog. It's official. Pack your Parker. World Cup 2022 will be held in November and December of 2022. FIFA announced last week the final would be held in Qatar on December the 18th. How Christmassy, Rog?
There's been a huge sturm and drung about this, obviously, from the European clubs who are disgusted that their league schedule is going to have to be ripped up and reconfigured. I mean, there's a thousand reasons this is ridiculous, but no one, Dave, and I can't understand it, no one has said World Cup 2022 is now going to conflict with Hanukkah. Where's the outcry?
Yeah.
FIFA have also fired the starting gun on World Cup 2026. They've announced that the decision on who will host the tournament, I can't wait, is going to be announced in May 2017. At Stamford, Lola tweeted us and said, I bet they give it to Antarctica, but play it in 2300 when the polar ice caps have fully melted. What we want to know, Davo, is if American citizens want to send bribes for World Cup 2026 bid. Do we make checks directly out to Sepp Blatter or do we make them to FIFA?
He prefers cash and watches, Rog. Cash and watches.
I did tweet and ask him, and then I got a tweet from somebody who worked at FIFA, just one word, it said bitcoins.
Ultimately, Rog, we don't really care about the men's World Cup. We only care about the real World Cup, the women's World Cup, coming up this summer in Canada, Rog. And time to introduce our guest.
Our guest today is a midfielder for the US national team. She's earned an eye-popping 217 caps. She's won 3 Olympic gold medals. And most importantly, she introduced us when we had Megan Rapinoe on to the term getting weird. She's one of my favourite US players of all time. I'm so excited to welcome her to the pod. A GFOP, a US soccer veteran, a woman who we are confident will help us to win the World Cup in Canada this summer. From East Brunswick, New Jersey, welcome to the pod, Heather O'Reilly.
Woo! Thank you. What an introduction. Thank you for having me. I'm loving being here.
I'm honoured. Heather Ann O'Reilly, HAO. The World Cup starts on June the 6th. That is just 76 days away. Can you describe your mental state right now?
Yeah, I think that as a team, we've really made some big strides over the last couple of months. We're obviously trying to always mesh what we've always been great at, and that's, you know, our physicality, our athleticism, our attitude, our competitiveness. And we're always layering in now, you know, different forms to break down very good teams. And, you know, I think that, you know, that's not an easy task, as a lot of teams across the world are getting stronger and stronger. So we are confident in where we are right now, and I'm feeling good and healthy and, you know, ready to play whatever role the team has for me. But, yeah, I think that we're feeling great.
You're in Long Beach, California, a U.S. women's national team training camp for 1 week before you go to St. Louis for the team's match against the Lady Ferns of New Zealand, April 4th. I've always wondered about camp. How are roommates selected?
Well, I'm looking at my roommate right now, the stunning Kelly O'Hara. We're good buddies. I think this is one of the first times we've been roommates in a while. But I think, you know, we change up our roommates a lot. So I think that that's cool because you really get to know people, you know, when you're sleeping about 3 feet away from them. Yeah, it's a good way to kind of, you know, get to know everybody on the team. But I think that there's some regulars, you know, that, you know, you kind of have your go-to roommates that they sort of know that you're, you know, good friends with or it works for you. You know, you don't want one person that's like snore super loud laying next to, you know, somebody that's a super late sleeper. So they've kind of worked it out through the years.
Well, I always wonder that because, you know, in life you get to share rooms with toe pickers and sleepwalkers and all that stuff. But what happens when you are put with a plain old snorer and it starts to affect you on the field? We don't, when we watch someone have a bad game, we don't think, wow, you know, they're not really playing. We don't go think, well, they must be paired up with a roommate who's a snorer.
Yeah, I know. I mean, you think that it's like maybe they're fatigued or they're having just a shocker. You didn't think about maybe that Abby Wambach was just chainsaw snoring next to them the night before. No, yeah, everybody kind of has their quirks, but I think that, yeah, we've done a good job getting to know each other and loving each other through our weird roommate tendencies.
Wambach and I are more alike than I thought before this interview. But the good news is your team just won the Algarve Cup, Mazel Tov. The challenge is you're yet to become a truly consistent whole. How is it from the inside? How do you understand why it is that you've not kind of been a consistent team yet?
Well, like I said, I think that, you know, we're trying to make jumps in our game, make strides. I think that we know if we stay sort of the same, you know, eventually teams will catch up. So I think in doing that, you are going to see growing pains. And, you know, I just think that it's just a general growth thing. There's going to be ups and downs, but we're obviously looking to peak in June. And we've seen, you know, glimpses of what we can do. And I think that some of those really shining moments led to gold in the Algarve Cup, and we're excited to see a lot of our training paying off. So We're confident that, you know, we're going to, like I said, bring what we've always brought. And I think that that's valuable, and that's something that should be feared. But I think that everybody across the world and our opponents are going to see another level from us in terms of sophistication in our attack and sending numbers forward and breaking down defenses in different ways, not just one or two variations.
You've got an English-born coach at the helm, Jill Ellis. English leaders, in my limited experience, they come on a range from Mary Poppins amazing to Margaret Thatcher terrifying. How would you place Jill's style?
Well, I think a lot of us have known Jill for a long time, whether it's with the U21s, and some of the players on the team here have played with her in college. And so when she became named the head national team coach, I think there were, you know, questions how she would sort of transition from being an assistant, where a lot of times you can sort of be a little bit more lighthearted and be sort of that connection between the head coach and the players, to now being the head coach. And I think that she's done a wonderful job in that transition. I think that she does bridge that gap well in terms of, you know, she's no question the authority and, you know, the number one leader in this group. But at the same time, she's a nice person, and she's a reasonable person. If you had, you know, something come up in your life, or, you know, a question that, you know, you wanted an answer from her, she's great to sit down with you and chat about it.
The group of death awaits. You got Nigeria, the best team out of Africa, the fearsome Matildas of Australia, 10th in the world, and 5th-ranked Sweden, led by your old coach, Pia Sundhage, the mother of dragons. This World Cup's been played in Canada, even more pressure because it's so close, and Degrassi Junior High was made there. But there's a huge amount of expectation on you guys, massive opportunity as individuals in terms of endorsements if the US win. What creates more pressure for you, the opponents or the expectation?
You know what? I think that both of those are sort of external pressures even still. And I don't think that anybody puts more pressure on us than ourselves. We have a very high standard for ourselves. That's why all the individuals are here. I love that mentality that it's, you know, we want to win. Anything less than gold isn't good enough for us. So I think that internally we have very high standards for ourselves. So all that kind of background noise is just that. And we're trying to obviously stay focused as a group and not let distractions concern us.
Playing football is so fun. There's no doubt. It is beautiful. I watch you, and you on the field have this incredible persona just of joy whenever you get the ball. But the World Cup is such a stressful entity. Is it actually fun playing the World Cup? or does it just become game face, game time, incredible pressure, great memories afterwards, but an incredible stressor?
It's a different kind of fun. I mean, it's not like a Friday night getting beers with your friends fun. It's a different kind of enjoyment and passion, and I think that that's sort of what makes the elite is, you know, you do embrace that moment of stress, and you find the joy in it. And I think that the really cool thing about this group is that, you know, our training sessions are tough. I mean, the way that we go against each other in, like, inter-squad games or, you know, 5v5 tournaments and things like that, they really do sort of prepare you for those big moments, because these games that we have are like life and death, even at practice every day. So I think that, you know, our preparation is good, and, you know, everybody is looking to be at their individual best for the team.
Does the pressure filter into your dreams? Do you ever have stress dreams about this World Cup with German keeper Nadine Angerer just swatting away every shot?
I don't really have that many soccer dreams, but I think, yeah, it manifests itself in other ways. Like, I bite my fingernails, for instance, and, yeah, like, they're getting lower and lower as the tournament comes. But I have a couple of bleeders, I think.
Entering a tournament, do you positively visualize winning, or do you tell yourself we're going to take it one step at a time?
I think that's sort of like, I think what sports psychologists would call like the long-term and the short-term goals. So, you know, you kind of have that, you know, vision out there, but you know, obviously, that it's sort of like one step in front of the other before you can get to that point. So obviously, that's the major goal. But you know, we're really concentrated on Australia. It's our first game. Even though it's going to be a tough opponent to start off the tournament.
You've made your debut for the US when you were still in high school. Whenever I think about you and I remember that fact, it's just unbelievable. You were just 17 years old when you took the field for the first time in 2002. The US then were world champions. They've not won that title since. You've won 3 Olympic gold medals. Is that enough for you, or would you trade them all in for a World Cup win to cap off your career?
I mean, I'm really proud of the gold medals. I think that, you know, for women's football especially, the World Cup and the Olympics are, you know, more sort of equal, I guess, in terms of, you know, the teams involved and the talent involved and stuff like that. So we're very, very proud of those golds at the Olympics. Obviously, as a footballer, you know, the World Cup is the pinnacle for the sport. So, you know, I've gotten bronze and I've gotten silver, and I'm very hungry to finish it up with gold there. So, you know, it's definitely not enough. I think that, you know, the good thing is we sort of have short-term memory with what we've done in the past, and we're just eager to get it done this summer.
Yeah, we asked our listeners for questions. This one came in from a super listener, Paul Carr, the great statistical mind at ESPN. He wrote to us and said, Heather pulls this amazing face. This is me editorializing now. When you're burning down the wing, you pull this cartoonish look of determination and just general amazingness. Paul Carr wanted to know, what are the origins of your fierce HAO face, and are you aware of pulling it when you're running down the wing during games?
The game face has definitely become notorious in the women's soccer world. I don't know what goes on when I'm up on the field. I think that it's like a genetic thing because I've looked back. I have 3 older brothers, and my dad was a very good athlete. He ran track in college and All-American and all that kind of stuff. So I look back at old photos and kind of like everybody in our family is doing this like really intense grimace. So, yeah, I think it runs in the family a little bit. I definitely don't know that I'm doing it. It definitely doesn't make my photos may be the most attractive. I'm glad that my husband loves me even through the game face. Yeah, you know what? If it works, I'm not going to change it. And it's the game face has been good to me through the years.
Every family has something. Baldness. For male men and women side in the Bennett family, I think you're actually quite blessed compared to us. You're in the team, in the locker room. You're an incredible... a lot of the pranks are targeted Heather O'Reilly, but when people need to be pumped, I believe you've got an incredible rendition of Lose Yourself that you pull out in the locker room.
Oh, that was years back. You know, that was when 8 Mile was like in the theater, that Eminem was king of the music scene. So I sort of retired that one, but that's not to say that the girls won't request it to come back out. But yeah, I feel like some people in the locker room, like, really kind of need to get in the zone, and I respect that, but I'm somebody that, like, to prepare for a game, I almost need to get a little bit of energy out because maybe that's good to get a little bit of nerves out. So I think about it like this. I can't be embarrassed on the field or disappointed on the field because I just completely embarrassed myself in the locker room by rapping or dancing. So it's all up from there, basically.
His palms are sweaty, knees weak, arms are heavy. There's vomit on his sweater. Already mum's spaghetti.
Mom's spaghetti.
Some of the most inspirational lines I can imagine before a massive World Cup game. A GFOP John Clark sent in this question. It's to do with your roommate, actually. He remembered how ahead of the US's second World Cup game last summer, the men's team, Alex Morgan, Sidney LaRue, and your roommate Kelly O'Hara dressed up in US jerseys and tutus to give the team some kind of an ostentatious show of social media support. Do you guys expect members of the US men's national team to dress up in tutus to reciprocate this summer?
If Michael Bradley is not wearing a tutu, I will be severely disappointed. And if he's listening to that, that's a dare.
He does listen. He does. I've got to say, for Mix Diskerud, 2-2's a standard off-field garb for that hero.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's why I expected it from Mix. I mean, that's no question. But Michael is like a little bit more of a stretch, so that'll really show his commitment to the team.
Yeah, Carl Beckerman, he's got beautiful legs and he loves to show them off. And Guzan, just Guzan. But do you hang out with, do you know those guys well, or are you like completely separate entities that pass like ships in the night?
No, I don't know any of the guys on the team. Yeah, we definitely sort of stay separate. I wish that we would do more things together, to be honest. Sometimes we're here at StubHub Center together training, but I think it would be cool to mix in for do like a five-a-side tournament or something like that. It would be pretty neat, but we've never done it.
Pay-per-vision.
I will say my buddy in the MLS is Dax McCarty. He's my good friend from college. We were neighbors in college, and we've stayed friends through the years. So whenever Dax is on...
We're very pro-Gingy. We're very pro-Gingy on Men in Blazers. Do you watch Premier League football at all? Is there a team that's established itself in your affections?
Yeah, of course. I try to watch as much as I can, and I've been a Manchester United fan for the years. I used to date this English guy, and he lived by Manchester. So I kind of got into Man U. And
stay away from English guys, Heather.
Well, I've learned my lesson. Now I'm married to a Canadian guy. I have something against the good old American boys, I guess.
We're a terrible people, but we're unreliable and untrustworthy. But it doesn't surprise me. You're actually a bit like Ashley Young, but good.
I'll take that compliment. He's had some success through the years.
The way you beat players off the dribble, I didn't know you were a United fan, but there's a touch of Everton Seamus Coleman's in your play, but you're a better crosser.
Well, I like that duel. I like looking across the field, seeing who I'm going to be, you know, going after, and you know, knowing I'm going to beat her. And usually it turns out to get across into Abby Wambach or Alex Morgan, but... Yeah, I like that duel. I like that part of soccer. It's one of my favorite things about the game is 1v1 situations. I think it's a sort of mentality that I picked up through Anton Dorrance, legend coach there at UNC in my college days. But we really embrace that 1v1 dueling. So try to use that to my benefit on the field.
Like Seamus Coleman, but good. At Morgan Lozano, last question for you. We get this question every time we have a US women's national team player grace the pod. Heather O'Reilly, what actress would you play you in the undoubtedly forthcoming biopic? We are making a film. We're casting it pod to pod. We know that Megan Rapinoe will be played by Tilda Swinton. We also know that Alison Williams has reportedly signed on to play Alex Morgan in this film that we're going to make when you land it all, when you win it all gloriously in Canada. But who would play you? Who should we be trying to talk to their agent for?
Well, I've been told by, I think, one person one time that I sort of resemble Jennifer Gardner. So she could potentially step into the role. I don't know. I've never seen her play soccer or do anything athletic, but I would be curious if she could fill in my shoes.
I've never seen her play soccer, but I put money on the fact that she's better than Ashley Young, too. I made a short list for you. Elizabeth Banks, Kate Blanchett, Maura Tierney. Maura Tierney.
Maybe.
Kristen
Maybe
Wiig. Kristen Wiig.
Well, she's hilarious, so.
I'd honestly, I'd like to throw my hat in the ring to play you. I would love to play Heather O'Reilly in the bio. I'd love to play you in life. Just type Heather O'Reilly into Tumblr and see the sheer number of amazing memes that come up related to you. Each one stuffed with joy. You are the antithesis of how I go through life. You're an approach that everyone should aspire to. I just want to wish you Godspeed for the weeks ahead. I want to wish the entire team the best of luck. We could not be more excited about everything that is to come. I could not be more excited about the Women's World Cup. Heather O'Reilly, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Roger. Thanks, everybody there, and thanks for backing us all the way.
What a human being. When I speak to a Davo, I'm more convinced than ever that there's glory just around the corner for this great country. And I'm also reminded I must file my citizenship papers.
Yes,
paperwork. The paperwork is a biatch, Rog. Okay, on to the Ravens. Our first Raven from PDX Todd Diskin. Which is worse to experience in Europe? Everton's unraveling or Arsenal doing what they do best? Almost winning, Rog.
Essentially, at PDX Todd Diskin is asking, is it better to lose and get absolutely obliterated 5-1, humiliated, bare-bottom spanked in public? Or is it better to do what Arsenal did, which is almost, Dave, it's what Arsenal do so well, face the impossible, almost pull off the impossible, come within a hair of pulling off the impossible, only to just completely kind of fall off the cliff at the last second?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it's still losing. It still falls into the same category, Rog. Whether it's almost winning or getting hammered, it's losing. And surely, I understand, like, we want thrilling games, we want thrilling individual play, but ultimately, surely the point of sport is to win.
You're saying that surely the point is to win. They're asking which way is a better way to lose, to get absolutely obliterated or to almost win.
There's no better way to lose, Rog. It's just exactly the same. To me, there's no difference between the two positions. It's both losing.
Sometimes I listen to you and think you're so American. There's a great piece on the BBC's website by Tom Fordyce.
Yeah, great piece.
Who asked, what is happiness in fandom? And he spoke to scientists and he said, the happiest fans are actually those with the lowest expectations. Mm-hmm. Cambridge University, a professor of neuroscience who's called Wolfram Schultz. I think if he has an American serviceman parent, we could get him to play for the United States. He said the amount of dopamine, the neurotransmitter that, among other things, helps control the brain's pleasure centers, he says what is released is directly related to how much you're expecting an event to occur. The best way to be as a fan is to have maximum emotional investment in the team, but the least expectation of success, because that's what rules the dopamine release. Which I suggest that Arsenal fans had it worse, I guess, Davey.
The hope that kills you, Rog. It's the hope that kills you.
I've got to be honest. Watching Everton be decapitated and defenestrated was amongst the worst fan experiences I've had. Arsenal still have got a fourth-place trophy coming, at least, Dave. Watching us just absolutely obliterated in Ukraine, it was as if I was watching the very floorboards of the club be ripped out before my eyes.
Oh, I'm sorry, Rog. The winner of the coveted Guinness Men in Blazers Poet, Philosopher, Soccer Scribe, Raven of the Week is Ben Murray. My wife, Sarah, and I are expecting our first child around the end of June. Congratulations, Ben and Sarah. We're opting for a surprise on the gender front, but boy or girl, he or she will be a red as a supporter of Toronto FC / Liverpool. Sorry, Rog. I know you've touched on the subject on several occasions on the pod, but I was curious if you had any specific book recommendations for an expectant father. Thanks to you both, I'm now a dedicated EPL viewer, which will make those early mornings slightly more bearable. But I would very much value your guidance on the subject of parenthood. There to Josie, Ben Murray. What is your best piece of advice you've ever been given on fatherhood?
Call your child Primo, Hector, or Hibbo. Those are my names. That's my list. Always, we've talked in the past how you should always negotiate with extreme names. Open the negotiating of extreme names to kind of back your partner into the one you really want. I always avoid giving advice to soon-to-be dads, David. I think the experience is so sui generis. You've got no idea how your partner's going to take to motherhood or parenthood, how the baby's going to be temperament-wise, how you'll react to fatherhood. Some dads adore it. Others instantly become workaholics in kind of a now or never, I must make it all now kind of way. I don't think there's any kind of one-size-fits-all piece of advice to give other than don't be afraid. Babies aren't fragile. They can even withstand more than Brendan Rodgers' ego.
My only piece of advice is during the actual birth, stay above 2 o'clock. That's my only real piece of advice. What I already love is that boy or girl, you've already stated they're going to be a red, they're going to love the football. My happiest memory of my daughter JJ was just watching football in that title-winning season 2004-2005 with my just little baby girl wearing her blue onesie, Rog, one of my happiest memories.
Do you know, when I was born, my dad was late to the labour room because he couldn't work out which tie to wear with his blazer.
That's so English. Do you know what's even more English, Rog? My dad didn't have to go to the labour room because I was born in the front room of my parents' house in 1966, Rog.
Oh, my dad also, for my brother, decided to play a game of hockey instead of come to watch my mum give birth is the family story. I've got two quick pieces of advice that I've thought about. I'd say number one, find an amazing, massive television show to Netflix every night in that first couple of months so that you and your partner have a communal bond and don't drift away from each other. I watched The Wire with one of my kids, well, for one of my kids, and I rewatched The Sopranos entire thing for another. And I wouldn't read any books. I definitely wouldn't read What to Expect When You're Expecting. It just terrifies you. If you can read one book, read a book I mentioned in January, that Department of Speculation by Jenny Offal, which is depressing as hell. It won't teach you how to change a diaper, but it will make you think about what it's like to happen from the POV of your partner, which probably is the most important thing.
Okay, Roger, in last week's newsletter, we announced the winner of our hashtag Mixed Masters main contest. As you'll recall, we asked you to Photoshop Mixed Disc Root's hair onto someone or something. The winners, GFOP's Benjamin and Lisa Reed, took Mix's hair and put it on everyone's favourite benevolent dictator, Sepp Blatter. They'll receive an NYCFC away shirt and hairbrush, both signed by Mix. We received so many amazing entries. We selected four runners-up. They will receive a copy of EA Sports FIFA 15. You can see all the winning entries on meninblazers.com. And a reminder about another contest we have going on. The GFOPs at EA Sports, so generous, Rog. They've bestowed upon us a special custom edition Robbie Keane Xbox. It was part of their FIFA 15 Green Keane tournament, which took place last week. Since Apple has overlooked gingers in its latest emoji package, we've asked for your help to create a ginger emoji. An example by producer Lexi is on our Instagram feed. Help eradicate anti-gingerism and get the Xbox, courtesy of EA Sports FIFA 15. Your international break weekend looks like this, Rog. England versus Lithuania, all not in the face, 3:45 p.m. Eastern Time on Friday on Fox Sports 2. Scotland versus the mighty Gibraltar, noon Eastern Time Sunday on ESPN Deportes and ESPN 3. And in an MLS, Real Salt Lake versus Toronto FC, that's 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Fox Sports 1. Many ways to connect to us. One is through our Amazon Emporium, which helps keep the show going. Anytime you go on Amazon for items big or small, just click off the Emporium page. Men in Blazers gets a tiny percentage that allows us to cover the cost of creating this podcast. Rog, what are you putting in the Emporium this week?
Oh, Dave, it's a book I'm a huge admirer. We've talked about this before, the Blizzard Football Quarterly, created by Jonathan Wilson. If you've not ordered it, check it out. It is one of the most rich, thoughtful football publications I've ever come across. They've got a books division, which is a hidden gem. And I just read a book called Erbstein, Football's Forgotten Pioneer by Dominic Bliss. It is an inspirational story about a Hungarian bloke who survived the Holocaust, then played in Europe and the USA before leading a tactical revolution to form what we see as the identity of modern Italian football, only to perish with his Torino team in a plane crash tragedy, a famous, iconic Italian plane disaster. It is perfect reading for Passover. Grab that book now, Erbstein, Football's Forgotten Pioneer.
Once again, Rog, the difference between us is drawn so clearly. You've put in another book, and I've put in a television, Rog. I insta'd out a picture on my Instagram this past weekend of this amazing new Sony television I've got my hands on, which has a remote, Rog, that features a football button to optimize your viewing pleasure of American football or soccer. It's amazing, and it really works. It really does optimize your viewing of the game. This television, Rog, is made by Sony. In full disclosure, I am a Sony employee, Rog, but I do believe that Sony make the best televisions. The Sony XBR 55-inch X800B. Oh, 55 inches of pleasure, Rog. It's got 4K. I don't really understand what that is. It comes in a little under $1,500. Save up for it, maybe.
You'd make a very good employee at Circuit City, Dave. When I saw your Instagram post, in the NFL season, there was a meme that came round of a Photoshop remote control that had all the buttons on it. It had one for NFL. And everyone laughed and said, wouldn't that be amazing if you just push a button and instantly get NFL games? When I saw you post yours, I thought yours was Photoshop too. I had no idea it was the real deal.
It's the real deal, Rog. Our friends at Sony doing great work for the football-loving public.
You push the button and you hear Ray Hudson having an instant orgasm on command.
Yeah, you hear him in even more clarity, Rog. It's so good. You can also connect to us through meninblazers.wickerspaces.com. That's a wonder of the modern world. Also, Rog, our website, meninblazers.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter, The Raven, which we produce with our partner, Guinness. You can follow us on Twitter. Happy birthday, Twitter, at meninblazers, at Rog Bennett, at Embassy Davies. On Instagram, at meninblazers, or embassy_Davies. Also, go to our Facebook page. We've got a subreddit, Rog, meninblazers.reddit.com. It's maintained by GFOP's Akshay, Calvin, and Alex. We now have a Spotify account also. Search men_in_Blazers. Our second Men in Blazers mixtape is now up. It's the Champions League edition, Rog.
Oh, yeah, we're coming up with our third very, very, very soon. I may start a Snapchat very soon, David.
Ooh.
I'm trying to work out if I just need to put part my body parts on it or if I can use it for the force of good.
Very true. Okay, you can always send your Ravens to the crap part of Soho. You can always email us at meninblazers@gmail.com. Vendorpunk Rog.
War pig.
Who wants to sex Mutombo?
Explosure.
Courage.
Creme de la crap.
Is that your analysis?
To tweed.
Abrogado. Rock on, mate.
Kung fu fight in America.
Love you, Rog.
Love you, David. Come home soon.
Miss you.
Hate international weekends.